To come back here and be with family, which is what I feel like. Rick and Marie I've known for I don't know how many years now. It's been a long time, but we'll know them a lot longer in heaven. Anyway, I always like to start out with a little bit of humor, because the Bible says a merry heart doeth good like a medicine. Indeed. So, who was the most depressed prophet in the Bible? The most depressed prophet. Well, most people would say Jeremiah, and that's probably... Oh, there we go. Got to be precise here.
Okay.
That's true of life, too. It has to be precise. Anyway, Jeremiah is probably the technically correct answer. He was known as the weeping prophet. But there was one prophet even more depressed than he. And that was Jonah. You see, he was really down in the mouth. Okay. Oh, thank you. All right. Who is the first aviator mentioned in the Bible? The first aviator. Well, believe it or not, he's in the New Testament. You probably have heard of him. It was Pontius Pilate. Okay. Maybe just one or two more. Who is the first man in the Bible to have died from a foot ailment that is usually not fatal? He died from a foot ailment that is usually not fatal. Well, it was Samson. You see, he died from fallen arches. Okay, just one more. How do we know that Job was always cold in his bed at night? Well, I figure he must have been cold in his bed at night. The Bible says he had such miserable comforters. Okay, so this is not working?
Yeah, it's ringing.
What's ringing? Huh? Oh, boy. All right. So I need to back up from this, or will you turn this off?
I'll turn it off.
Okay. Okay. Whoa, there we go. Well, ask and you shall receive, and I didn't even ask, so that's pretty good. Okay. Well, today we're going to be looking again, if I can get this thing to work, which is questionable. Oh, it's got to be on. Gee. Oh. When all else fails, turn it on. Okay. All right. There we go. We're going to be looking again at biomimetics, which means biomimicry or copying design first seen in the world of biology. And many times we find that scientists are looking to the world of biology to find designs and engineering solutions that can save them R&D expenses, that can be copied and used for our own technology. Excuse me. However, we've often found that many things that we thought we innovated, we thought, oh, we used our intelligence, our creativity. We are made in the image of God, so we can think up things and make works of art and machines and things that never existed before because we thought of them and invented them. But a lot of things that we take credit for as being the first ones to have invented it, God actually invented it first. And that's why I call this presentation, if I get the right button here, God invented it first. And there are many things that he not only invented first, he invented better and more efficient and more amazing than the recreations that we did later, thinking we were the first ones to think it up and invent it. Now, in this particular program, we're going to be looking at a lot of things that relate to how God changed the creation after the curse. When God created everything, he said, behold, it's all very good. There was no death, disease, sorrow, no predation. There were no dangerous, poisonous animals. Everything was in peace and harmony. But when Adam rebelled against the Creator, he was warned that death and a curse would come, and that's exactly what happened. And so it changed everything. God said, cursed is the earth, it will not be as productive. Women will have pain in childbearing. Man will have to scratch out a living by the sweat of his brow. It's not as easy as just living in the Garden of Eden. And by the way, how did God stop Adam and Eve from gambling? Well, he took away their paradise. Okay. Okay, just had to throw that one in there. Okay. Since we're talking about Adam and Eve, you know. No, anyway. So also, he said thorns and thistles would now be brought forth from the earth that weren't there before. So apparently God spoke with his creative power and genetically reprogrammed the creation so that all kinds of plants now have genes in them for thorns and thistles that were not there originally. Also, the animal kingdom fell under the curse. Everything under Adam's dominion fell under the curse. God said to the serpent, you are cursed above or to a greater extent than all the other beasts of the earth. So all the animals fell under the curse as well. And that involved physical changes and genetic changes. For example, the serpent was cursed to have to crawl on his belly and eat dust. Well, if he was already doing that, there wouldn't have been no curse at all. Apparently, serpents used to have legs and could walk above the ground with dignity, but after the curse, they were genetically re-engineered and had to crawl on their belly and eat dust. So a lot of changes took place, and in the world the way God originally intended it to be, with him being accepted by man and ruling and reigning as the sovereign king, animal populations would have been kept in control by his divine providence. He told the animals, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth as well. And as soon as they filled it as full as it should be, it would simply stop. There would be no death. We didn't have to worry about anything like that. It would just be the right, everything in the right proportion, just as God providentially decreed it to be. But with the world under the curse, it's kind of like, you know, Adam said, well, I believe the lie. The lie is that you don't really love me. You don't want me to realize the truth that I can be as God. And the serpent said, what? You will not surely die. So really, when God cursed the earth, he not only was fulfilling his word, because he can't lie, but also he was allowing every generation thereafter to look at this cursed world and see who is telling the truth at the beginning, God or Satan. God said, you know, you need me, you can't be like me, but you can follow me, and we can have a perfect eternity if you will choose of your free will to do that, but you can't be your own God. You're not qualified. Only God is qualified to be God and be the ultimate leader. If you try to lead yourself, there's going to be death and a curse and terrible things, and you will surely die. Satan said, no, he's lying. You will not surely die. Well, look at the world with all of its sin and suffering and decide who is telling the truth at the beginning. Every generation gets to see that God was telling the truth and Satan was lying. But right on the heels of pronouncing death and a curse, God says there will be forgiveness and restoration for those who will repent. He said, the seed of the woman, Genesis 3:15, the proto-evangelium, the first preaching of the gospel, the seed of the woman, not a man, because Jesus had a earthly mother, but not an earthly father. The seed of the woman will come and crush the head of the serpent, and he will become a curse for us. We'll be redeemed from the curse. He will die in our place, so we'll be redeemed from death forever. And because of his redemption and restoration, we will all inherit a new heaven and new earth where righteousness dwells, where there's no more sorrow, no more sickness, no more pain, no more tears, no more curse, and no more death, for the former things will have passed away. But in the meantime, we live in this topsy-turvy world of contrast and contradictions, and there's beautiful things here because because we have remnants of the very good earth God created. There's beauty here, but there's also ugliness because of the curse. There's happiness here, but there's also sorrow. There's health here, but there's also sickness. There's fragrance here, but there's also stench. There's life here, but there's also death. And only the Bible explains why the world is in the mess it's in, not because God created it that way, but because man brought death and a curse on the creation to whom it was given to Adam the dominion. And so God, in his mercy and love and grace, sent the last Adam, his son, the creator of the universe, to die in our place, to become a curse, and to restore all things. But in the meantime, we're kind of caught in this topsy-turvy world between heaven and hell with a taste of both. So if you like the beautiful, wonderful things of this life, make sure you go to heaven, because the beautiful things in this life are just a taste of what heaven is holding for us. If you don't like the ugly, horrible things of this life, make sure you don't go to hell, because with the curse, we have just a taste of what hell will be like. And God has allowed us to see who is telling the truth and what the effect of sin is, hoping that it would influence us to make the right choice and to accept the seed of the woman, the promised Savior of the world, the last Adam, Jesus Christ. So we have, in a situation like this, in the animal kingdom, this kind of warfare that would not have been there if Adam had obeyed. And when God's providence is pushed away, he didn't completely remove his providence, or everything would be like hell. You know, we have a lot of beauty and good things still left over. But even with his partially withdrawing his providence because of the curse, we now have animals kept in a proper balance, not by God's providence, but by a prey-predator relationship. There's kind of a war in nature, you know, as Darwin said, but it's not there because God created it that way. Man brought it upon himself with his sin and rebellion. But in a warfare situation, just for animals to survive, they have to have defensive strategies, defensive implements and tactics. And we see that when God spoke the curse, he also exhibited some of his grace in giving to these creatures abilities to cope and survive in a fallen world. And a lot of what we're going to see today are strategies that we thought up in our own system, because we live in a fallen world where there's often war and selfishness and strife. We often are attacked by enemies and have to defend ourselves, and we have to use strategies to do that. But we didn't think of these things first. God thought of them and invented them first. Now, one thing we're going to look at is the invention of written language. You know, man probably thought he invented written language, and this goes back thousands of years, these clay tablets from Babylonia. But even though man invented written language thousands of years ago, he didn't invent it first. God invented it first with the marvelous language of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. Bill Gates said that this is by far the most sophisticated and efficient information storage and retrieval system known to exist in the universe. None of our supercomputers can compare. It can store so much information so much more compactly than any computerized system, even in the 21st century. God did it first, and he did it better. As I pointed out before, for a less than average sized DNA molecule, which is not life by a long stretch, but is necessary for life, the odds are 1 chance in 10 to the power of 2,200 conservatively, number one with 2,200 zeros. You compare that to the estimated number of atoms in the known universe, which is only about 10 to the power of 80, the number one with 80 zeros, you can see that this is utterly impossible to overcome, even with trillions times trillions of years, even with trillions times trillions of universes, with all their atoms randomly mixing together again and again, trying to come up with this right combination that's very specific and very necessary just once. There is no hope at all that that could happen, not even close, in trillions times trillions of years with trillions of universes. And that's just a peep-squeak, less than average-sized DNA molecule, which is helpless and hopeless without all the other complex systems of the cell to go with it. And a living cell is so complex. If we had a dream team of all the greatest scientists in the world with the trillions of dollars in the world's bank at their disposal, they could not, for love nor money, start from scratch with the basic chemical elements and put together a living and reproducing cell. Is beyond our technological capability. And that cell can do things none of our machines in the 21st century can do. Can you imagine us building a machine that would extract raw elements and energy from the environment, build itself up, maintain itself, repair itself automatically, and then make virtual exact copies of itself over and over again without any outside help, without any outside maintenance and repair? And not only do that, which none of our machines can do, but to keep doing it for thousands of years without outside maintenance and repair. It's inconceivable that we could make any machine that would last like that and have such marvelous capabilities. Yet the tiniest single cell has that level of technology. It has the fingerprints of God all over it. And there's simply no way to explain it without the omniscience and omnipotence of a creator being responsible. Now then, I'm sure living in the desert, you know what this is. It's not an air conditioner. It's a swamp cooler. Yes. Uses the principle of evaporative cooling, and as a result, it adds more humidity to the atmosphere, which in the desert is a nice thing to have. Air conditioners tend to take it out, but a swamp cooler adds it, which is indeed a good thing. Now then, that's not something that man invented and figured out. Oh, evaporative cooling, God invented it thousands of years ago with the bees. The bees act as heating and air conditioning technicians. They actually keep the hive at an optimum temperature of about 95 degrees, which is what they need for their grubs to develop properly. And if it gets too warm or too hot, it can be fatal. If it gets too hot or too cold. Now, in the winter, they're not out foraging for food, so tens of thousands of them will gather on the honeycomb, and they'll rev their engines. They'll beat their wings and buzz. They're not trying to take off. But the rapid muscle contraction produces body heat that brings the temperature of the hive up to its correct temperature. Then they all stop, kind of like a thermostat. You know, it comes up to the right temperature, everything cuts off. They all have their built-in thermometers, so they know when it's the right time to cut off. Then if it comes down again a little bit, they'll rev it up until it's right. And they can keep it within plus or minus 2 degrees of that optimum temperature, no matter how cold or how hot it gets in the winter or in the summer. Now, in the summer, of course, that's where they need the evaporative cooling. They collect in their nectar sacs, instead of nectar that they usually bring back and process into honey, they collect water. Then they take and put drops of water all over the honeycombs inside the hive, and a bunch of them get at the entrance of the hive, and they beat their wings like a big fan and blow air through the hive, just like the swamp cooler. It's a forced draft through the hive. It evaporates the water. If it starts getting too cold, they stop for a while. When it gets a little too warm, they start up again, just like a thermostat. God invented it first. Now then, From ancient times, man has realized in military warfare you need to hide from the enemy as best you can. So we use camouflage on our military equipment, we camouflage ourselves. But this is not a new strategy that man thought of. God thought of it first. For example, here we have the Egyptian nightjar, which has mottled gray feathers that almost perfectly mimic the type of sand and dirt in its environment. It can nest in that sand and be practically invisible. Now, what do we have here? Well, it's a lizard. But again, it's designed by God to have amazing correlation with the color and texture of the bark of the trees that it likes to rest upon. And what do we have here? Anybody know what this is? Well, it's a grouse-like creature called a ptarmigan. But what you may not realize, because God is such an expert at camouflage, is that there are six of them in this picture. Yeah. God thought of camouflage first and did it better than we ever did. Now, the other ones are babies. There's a couple of them here, okay? And there's a couple up here, and there's one over here. The babies have a little bit of brown mixed with them that make them disappear even better than the mama. But God's pretty good, isn't he? Now, snipers, when they go into a certain area where they know ahead of time they're going to be sniping, they'll go in and take the actual grasses from that environment and foliage from that environment and weave it into their ghillie suit or sniper suit, because they don't want to stand out against the different color in that environment. They don't want to have a clash of color. And that's a very good strategy, but it's not something man thought of first. God gave that wisdom to what's called the decorator crab. The decorator crab takes pieces of sponge and adheres it to its body, and then nestles in among the sponges, and predators that like to eat crabs will often pass it over because it looks like a sponge and not a crab. And here we have what's called the sandy hunter bug. This bug extrudes a kind of a biological glue all over its body. Then it'll go to a sandy environment and roll in the sand and exactly match the environment. Here it's against wood grain, so it stands out quite prominently, but in the right sand where it matches, it virtually disappears. And one way, of course, to camouflage yourself is to look literally like something that you're not. This is the world's longest insect, not the biggest and heaviest, but the longest. It's called the walking stick. And it literally looks like a stick with branches coming out of it, but it actually is a six-legged insect. And here we have the prickly green variety of the walking stick, which does very well in green briars. And here we have the worms coming out of the offspring of the peppered moth. An amazing thing, they lay an egg on a brown branch, and the thing comes out bran and looks like part of the branch. This comes out green, looks like part of the branch. It's amazing what happens by chance, isn't it? My goodness. Okay, here we have the hooded grasshopper. Now, the hooded grasshopper has this big hood on it designed to look like a leaf. And when it nestles in among the leaves, it is very difficult to detect by predators. Here we have what looks like a broken leaf, but it's actually the broken leaf insect, often passed over by predators because it sure doesn't look like an insect. It looks like just a worthless broken leaf. And here we have the leaf grasshopper, which looks rather conventional from the side. But when it wants to disappear among leaves, it pulls its legs under its body and spreads out its wings, and it looks just like a leaf, including with the veins in the leaf. I mean, it's just marvelous camouflage capability that God gave it. Here we have the leafy sea dragon, related to the seahorse, and this will kind of drift in the current among seaweed and looks like just a broken branch of seaweed that most predators would pay no attention to at all. Now, one of the problems we have with camouflage is that even if you match the coloration of the background perfectly, you can still have a dark, sharp shadow betraying your presence. So experts in camouflage use a technique known as flanging and fringing to flange and cover up the shadow and then to fringe the edges so they blend in and there's no sharp line of delineation. God thought of this first, and he uses it with this creature. Now, does anybody know what this is back here? I don't know what it is either. The creature is actually right here. It is a caterpillar, and it's using flanging and fringing to make its shadow disappear. It looks like it's just part of the branch. It's amazing camouflage capability. Now, anybody know the name of this famous World War II fighter? It's the F-6F Hellcat, the first fighter in the Pacific, carrier-borne fighter that was more than a match for the Japanese Zero, using the RW-2800 radial 2,000 horsepower engine. Excuse me. It has the distinction of having the greatest kill ratio of any United States fighter in World War II. Anybody know what the kill ratio was? 19 to 1. very, very successful against the Japanese. Now, when you're flying in a three-dimensional environment, the enemy might be above you looking down on you. If so, you want to have dark blue on the top to match the dark blue of the ocean below, so you would not be as visible to the enemy. However, if the enemy is looking at you from below, for example, gunners trying to shoot you down, you want to have light blue on the bottom to match the light blue of the sky. So this is known as a two-tone camouflage. But man didn't figure this out and think it up in World War II. God thought it up first and gave this two-tone camouflage to a number of creatures, especially fish and sharks in particular. They have a light-colored underbelly, so if you're looking at them from below, the light color tends to match the light color of the illuminated water on the surface of the ocean. But if you're looking down on it, the dark gray matches the sand and mud on the bottom of the ocean. Now, we also have the ability to turn on lights to do that, and this is the bioluminescent squid. The bioluminescent squid has cells on one side that it can selectively light up to exactly the brightness that will match the brightness of the surface of the sea above it, so that predators looking at it, it'll practically disappear. But if you're looking from above down on it, it has a dark gray that matches, again, the color of the sand and the mud on the bottom of the ocean. Now, most people know what this creature is called. What is it? A chameleon. Yeah, chameleons are well known for being able to change their color. No matter what environment you put in, they can change their color to match their environment. A lot of people don't realize God gave that ability to other creatures too. One of them is the flounder, and there are frogs also that can do this, and they do this by these amazing surface cells called melanophoric cells. These cells have patches of color in them, little pieces of melanin, and these pieces, like pixels on a computer screen, can be rearranged in almost any way to match exactly the background. Now, how in the world would they do that? We don't know. We know they do it. We don't know if their eye takes a picture of the background and then that somehow is sent to their cells and the cells rearrange, or if the cells themselves have some kind of a sensing mechanism. We're not sure, but they do it very effectively. For example, here we have a flounder. The flounder can match very well. It's just landed here, but in a short time, it will match that sandy background so good that it will virtually disappear. Here we have flounders here trying to match a mottled background, and believe it or not, there is a flounder right here. Can you see it? It's perfectly matched that sandy background. In fact, on YouTube, you can look this up. It's very interesting. They took an experiment where they put a flounder in an artificial big aquarium, and they put a checkerboard pattern on the bottom of the aquarium, something the flounder would never encounter in the natural world. They put the flounder in there, it settled on the bottom. Within a few minutes, it matched the checkerboard pattern and virtually disappeared. Apparently, there's nothing that they can't do with this technology that God has given them. Now, here we have an interesting octopus called the mimic octopus, and it mimics the behavior of other animals in order to confuse and elude predators. One thing it likes to do is draw all of its legs back like this so it looks like a flounder. Okay, then it swims right along the bottom of the ocean just like a flounder, and many predators that like to eat octopus but don't care about flounder will just pass it by. Another thing it will do is to stretch out its arms so they look like the spiny fins of the lionfish. Okay, why would predators avoid a lionfish? Because at the end of those spiny fins are neurotoxins that sting like crazy. And so you learn to avoid lionfish or anything that looks remotely like a lionfish. Another thing it will do is mimic the behavior of one of the most venomous denizens of the deep, the sea snake. It already has black and white stripes, like the sea snake, but it'll bury all of its arms into the sand with just its eyes protruding, and then it will move those arms in a way a sea snake moves to make it look like there's two dangerous sea snakes there instead of a vulnerable octopus. So predators tend to back off in the face of a sea snake. Very interesting. Now we're going to look at General Patton's Ghost Army. This was actually classified for a number of decades after World War II. But George Patton was a very fiery individual, very gung-ho, and he encountered a couple of soldiers in a army hospital that didn't appear to have any visible wounds, and he said, "What's wrong with you?" "Well, we lost our nerve, you know, we just psychologically can't handle it." Today, that's recognized as a true debilitating state known as PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder. Back then, they called it shell shock in World War I and battle combat fatigue in World War II. But Patton thought they were just, you know, faking it, and that, you know, he was angry at them, so he slapped them. Well, in the Russian army and even in the Nazi army, if a general officer slapped a common foot soldier, it'd be no big deal. But in the West, where we tend to feel that people have dignity and are made in the image of God and are equal to each other in value, generals aren't allowed to slap foot soldiers. So General Patton got relieved of command. He was taken out of command of any army. Now, when that was reported, the Germans said, this is some kind of a sly trick. Why would they take their best strategic general, the one that they thought for sure, because he did so well against Rommel in North Africa, he would surely be the one chosen to lead the invasion of Europe. And they're saying he's been relieved of command for the infraction of slapping a soldier, which would be nothing to them. When our spies told that to our superiors, they said, ah, let's take advantage of that. Let's put General Patton in command of the First Army. The only problem is the First Army never existed. It was a ghost army. He later commanded the Third Army in Europe, which did many exploits with his armored divisions. However, there never was a First Army except for propaganda. And so they took reserve troops that were not going in the original invasion at Normandy, that would be backup troops going in later. They stationed them at Kent, England, right across from the most narrow portion of the English Channel, right across from Pas-de-Calais, France. Now, this, of course, was seen to be a prime means of invasion because only 20-some miles here, whereas Normandy is like over 100. So a lot more can happen in the water, especially if there's a storm and trouble like that going a long distance than a short distance. Well, they put General Patton in command of the First Army. They had him giving speeches and addressing to the troops. They had all kinds of radio traffic, said, yes, we're doing tank maneuvers and war games here and artillery practice here and infantry maneuvers here. And our double agent spies were reporting to the Nazis that, yes, General Patton will be leading the invasion, just as you suspected. However, he's got a trick up his sleeve. He is going to make a diversionary landing here at Normandy. And that's to get Hitler to take all his crack troops and his panzer divisions that are bottled up here at Pas-de-Calais and bring them over here. Now, as soon as they get over here to meet this invasion, he's going to come in behind him and split the forces in two at Pas-de-Calais. But the thing that really convinced the Germans, and Hitler in particular, that this was really true, it turned out to be one of the best uses of disinformation against the enemy in the annals of military warfare, the thing that really convinced them was their aerial reconnaissance that shows there was a vast mechanized force right across from Pas-de-Calais. Problem is, it wasn't real. It was inflatable vehicles. And they looked very real in aerial reconnaissance, but they were in fact just rubber dummies. And they had to take and put tank tracks and everything to look like they were maneuvering, but it really worked very well. They had inflatable aircraft there, like the B-26. They had inflatable artillery, and most importantly, inflatable landing craft. That's something that they knew was very important. They put just a few visible across from Normandy to make it look like, yeah, they're going to make a diversionary strike, but they put a lot of them right out in the open, right across from Pas-de-Calais. So it looked like, oh my goodness, they've got the means and the power to come across at Pas-de-Calais. They're going to draw us over in this feint at Normandy. And it worked so effectively that weeks after the landings of Normandy, Hitler would not release his top SS Panzer units to go after them at Normandy. He was sure they're going to sneak in at Pas-de-Calais. It worked like a dream. Now, does anybody know the name of this famous butterfly? Wrong. See, God thought of Patton's Ghost Army strategy before we ever did. The reason it worked was Patton made it look like he was strong where he wasn't, across from Pas-de-Calais, and made himself look weak where he was strong, across from Normandy. This creature looks almost exactly like a monarch, and that makes it terrible to predators, because monarchs carry poison in them, milkweed toxin. Any predator that eats a monarch goes, boy, I'm never going to eat one of those black and orange butterflies again. They're awful. So predators avoid monarchs, and if you look very much like a monarch, this is the real monarch here, this is the viceroy, which you thought was a monarch, and most predators do too. They're very subtle differences, but they look almost identical. Thus, looking strong when you're not can give you an advantage over your enemies, just like Patton's Ghost Army gave us an advantage at the invasion of Normandy. Now, what do we have here? A baby coral snake? Even baby snakes can be venomous, but this looks like the striping color of a coral snake, but it's actually a non-poisonous, innocuous, tropical caterpillar. That's all, but it would make you think twice if you saw it. What do we have here? A barn owl? Well, a lot of predators back off from a barn owl, but it's actually just a harmless moth. And oh my goodness, what do we have here? Well, if you're crawling through the grass and you see this, looks like maybe the head of a snake with big eyes, you probably back right away, but it's really just the rear end of a toad. But It sure looks like some dangerous animal, and that works well to make predators back off. Now, here we have one of the largest moths in the world, the Atlas moth. Notice on the top end of each wing, they have what looks like a cobra's head. That pattern is repeated on the bottom of the wings as well. So when the Atlas moth rests on a tree during the day and brings up its wings, it looks like two cobra heads facing outward. Not many would approach close to that. And yet, it's just a harmless moth and nothing more. Now, if you're climbing up a tree and you see this poke out of a leaf, you'll probably climb right back down. Again, baby snakes can be venomous. But this is not a snake, it just looks like one. It is a harmless caterpillar. And one that looks even more like a snake is this one. Boy, if ever that looked like a head of a snake, I don't know what does. Now, it's just the rear end of this caterpillar, and it's designed with an instinct that if you poke at it, it will strike at you as if it's a snake. Now, it doesn't have a mouth with fangs or anything, but it'll make you think, boy, it'll threaten you, and it's a bluff. You know, sometimes bluffing can get you out of a lot of trouble, and especially when you look like you're dangerous. Now, the opposite end of that is to be strong, but make your enemy think you're weak. In this case, in World War II, the Russians stationed tanks out on the Russian plains, but they covered them up with foliage to make them look like just a series of bushes. So the Nazi aerial reconnaissance would see just bushes, but not tanks, on the plains. General George Bernard Montgomery in North Africa against Rommel, he used this to great effect by covering up his Centurion tanks and making them look like mere harmless troop transports. So Rommel said, our aerial reconnaissance shows they don't have any armor on our flank. We don't have to worry about an attack on this flank because they have no armor. Well, actually, they had plenty of armor. It looked like they had nothing but troops. Excuse me. But when Rommel got attacked on his flank, he couldn't believe it because he didn't think they had anything there. But indeed, they made themselves look like they weren't dangerous when in fact they were. Now, does anybody know the name of this famous American tank in World War II? The M4 Sherman tank. When it first came out in 1942, it was one of the best tanks in the world. It was easily a match for the best German tank, the Panzer Mark IV. However, the Germans were shocked when they encountered the T-34 tank that the Russians had produced, which was superior to any of their panzers. And they thought, how could these subhuman Slavic people do better than us? So they went back to the drawing board, and they came out with the Panzer Mark V and Mark VI, also known as the Panther and the Tiger tank. Those were vastly superior to the original Sherman. They could knock out a Sherman a half a mile away. A Sherman would have to get within 60 yards to penetrate its frontal armor. Could do better from the sides or the rear, but it couldn't penetrate the frontal armor with this relatively short, low-velocity cannon, which was fine in World War II, but not later in the war. So the British came out with a version called the Firefly. They took their best long-barreled, high-velocity anti-tank gun and somehow jury-rigged it to fit in a Patton tank. And they came out with 2,000 of those by the time of the invasion of Normandy. The Germans said, if you see a short-barreled Sherman in front of you, they disdained it. They called it the door knocker. It'll knock on your armor, but it can't penetrate. Take your time, don't worry, they can't do anything. But they learned when the long-barreled Sherman came out, aye, 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 they can penetrate a Tiger tank at normal combat ranges of a half a mile. So they feared the Firefly. The Allies responded by putting this mottled type of camouflage on the end of the barrel. So up against the bright sky, it would not be as visible, and it would be more easy to see the dark portion of the barrel, which made it look like a short-barreled Sherman, which was not dangerous. And it was, in fact, this type of Sherman that knocked out the greatest Nazi tank ace. He was killed by a Sherman Firefly, perhaps thinking it was just a regular Sherman and he was safe. But he wasn't. Sometimes you want to look like you're not dangerous when you are in order to obtain an advantage. Now then, here we have one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in the world during World War II. This neighborhood was one of the main contributors to the downfall of the German Third Reich and the Empire of Japan. Why was this neighborhood so dangerous? Because it's not really a neighborhood. It is actually the roof of the Boeing aircraft manufacturing plant up near Seattle in World War II. They wanted it to look like it was just a regular neighborhood so that if the Japanese tried to do something like Billy Mitchell, or not Billy Mitchell, but Doolittle, the Doolittle raid where they put B-25 medium-range bombers on aircraft carriers and sent them out to bomb Japan and even bomb Tokyo, they didn't want the Japanese pulling off a trick like that either. So by covering the roof and making it look like an ordinary neighborhood, it'd be very hard to locate it. And yet, This Boeing aircraft manufacturing plant produced the famous B-17 Flying Fortress that brought the Germans to their knees, and the B-29 Super Fortress that eventually dropped the atomic bombs on Japan and was the last straw that ended World War II. Excuse me. Now then, here we have a dangerous predator, but it's designed not to look that way. Yeah, I think you can see it here a little bit better. What is it? Praying mantis. This is called the orchid praying mantis because its coloration is designed to look just like the colors of orchid leaves. Here we have a dangerous predator. It looks like a knot on a branch, but it's actually called the wraparound spider. And it's so flexible it can wrap around on a branch and just look like a knot on the branch. But any ant that walks over it, it'll reach out and grab it with one of its arms. Now here we have the A-10 Warthog, very effective ground attack aircraft, used very effectively against Iraqi armor in the Iraq War. It has a Gatling cannon with 7 barrels that rotate so fast it can shoot 65 rounds per second of high-velocity depleted uranium ammunition, which is 2.5 times denser than steel, and it will cut through the top armor of any known battle tank just like a hot knife through butter. With explosive rounds, it's very effective against troops in the field, such as terrorist troops. Well, the terrorists don't like that. They hate this thing, and they try to shoot it down with their gunnery. Now, to cope with that, they put a false canopy on the bottom of the aircraft to try to confuse the gunners about what direction it's actually facing. It's easier to pull positive Gs than negative Gs in a turn, so they might think, well, it's going to turn this way, when actually it's not. We can see it a little bit more clearly here. False canopy painted there, and that's again to confuse the gunners about the orientation of the aircraft. But this is not something man thought of first. It's been copied also by the Canadian Air Force, and even the Israeli Air Force is now putting false canopies on the bottom of their aircraft to confuse gunners and even opponents in aerial dogfights. But God thought of it first. For example, here we have a big false eye on the end of this fish. His real eye and mouth is pretty small, but if a predator is coming up behind and he sees a big eye and perhaps a big mouth with it, he's going to go, ooh, I think I'll back off, when it's actually a rather harmless fish. We see this often in butterflies that have these eye spots, again, to try to deter predators. And here we have the serval cat. The serval cat has black ears with white slits, look kind of like eyes peering out. In the tall grass, if a predator is coming up thinking it's sneaking up behind it, it'll look and say, oh my goodness, it's looking at me with its eyes. So I'll just go around behind it, and when it does, it gets in front of its real eyes, and it can't escape. Now then, all modern submarines use a variation in their weight to adjust buoyancy. They either take in water to make themselves heavier and submerge, or they use compressed air to expel the water from the ballast tanks, make themselves more buoyant, and they surface. But that taking in or expelling water in order to adjust buoyancy, although used in all modern submarines, is not a new idea. God invented it first and put it in his submarine called the Chambered Nautilus, which uses exactly the same principle that we use in modern submarines. Now, optic fiber cables is something man thought he invented first in the 20th century, and they're so much more efficient at carrying information than the old copper wires that almost all copper wire communication systems have been replaced with optic fiber systems. But man was not the first one to create optic fibers. God created it first, and if he didn't, our eyes would not work anywhere near as well as they do. In fact, they wouldn't hardly work at all if God did not invent this at the microscopic level. Now, at the back of your eye, we have this thin membrane called the retina, which is packed with rods and cones, light-sensitive cells. And it is very thin. It's about as thin as saran wrap. And yet, at the cellular level, there's enough for several layers of cells to be in that thin saran wrap type of retina that we have there. Now, the amazing thing is that the direction of the light being focused by the lens of the eye is coming from this direction, and it has to get down here to the light-sensitive rod and cone cells. But the design has all these other cells and all their wiring in front of the light that's trying to get down here. That's why evolutionists have said, we'll give it to you in color here, evolutionists have said, this is a bad design. This shows the eye must have evolved. No intelligent creator worth his metal would make such a foolish design of an eye. Of course, the best definition of a bad design is that it works bad. But as we can all see, if you'll pardon the pun, our eyes work quite well, don't they? And we don't have our vision obscured by all this stuff. So what's going on here? Well, all these other cells and their wiring are there for a very important purpose. If you live above the water, you don't have water depth to hide you from bright lights, you live on the land, you could have these cells burned out just by glancing at the sun by accident. You know, you hear an eagle cry and you look up and the sun's right there. You would be the effect of snow blind for days, if not a week or so. Blind. Because these cells burn out. But these cells rapidly, it's like unscrewing and screwing in new light bulbs, it replaces them so rapidly that you might see spots for a few minutes or so, and then it goes away. Without this system here, you see any bright light reflecting off of snow or off the water or happen to glance at the sun, you'd be snow blind for up to a week. Imagine what an impairment that would be. So this is a brilliant design to have this rapid repair system there, but it does get in the way of the light trying to reach the photoreceptors, but God thought of that too. He created optic fiber cables first, which are flared at the top to receive the image focused by the lens and bring them right down to the light-sensitive cells where they're needed. Because he invented optic fiber cables first, we can see very well indeed. Now, one thing that we have as an app on modern smartphones is an app for translation of language, which is really nice. If you go to Europe, you know, and you don't know Spanish, you don't know French or German, you can just push the app on your phone, speak into your phone, and it will speak out, translating the language, or it'll print it out on the screen. What a marvelous invention. But man was not the first one to invent translation machinery. God did it first with the amazing biosynthetic system in every living creature. We have a blueprint that specifies the growth and maintenance and self-reproduction of all living creatures. That blueprint, however, has to be read. And God created robots, the best way to say it, programmed robots molecularly that can read that code, understand it, and translate it into another language, an intermediate language called RNA, or ribonucleic acid. Then it further translates it from that language into the final language of proteins, which is the language of structure and function and regulation. So at the heart of all living creatures is the ability to have information stored that tells everything what to do, how to do it, when to do it, and how to do it well. And it's been doing that for thousands of years, but it can't do it unless the information is translated. And this translation mechanism is more complex than any machinery man has ever invented. Far more sophisticated than any of our cell phones, and God did it first. Here we have a camcorder, and you know, these are kind of nice. They're becoming somewhat obsolescent because our smartphones nowadays have such good photography and videography that they rival most any camcorder, and they can fit in your pocket, whereas a camcorder is a little bit bulky. They used to be much bigger. You have to hold them on your shoulder. I remember that back in the 80s. But God invented the camcorder first. Really, all this does is record sight and sound. But God gave us an amazing camcorder with our eyes, our optic nerve, and our brain, which has enough, terabytes of information that it could store several lifetimes worth of information, actually, and much more than that, in fact. However, we have a better camcorder in that it does more than just record sight and sound. It records input from all five of our senses. Imagine you went to the ocean. It was the best day you ever had at the ocean. The weather was absolutely perfect. It was sunny, but not too hot. There was a nice breeze, and you could see the beautiful sun glistening on the ocean. You could hear the shrill cry of the seagulls and the crash of the waves on the beach. So you have sight and sound, but you also could smell the salt in the air. If the waves splashed on you and got in your mouth, you could taste the briny, salty taste of the sea water, and you could feel the coolness of the water as it splashes against your legs. All five senses, but it does even more than that. It also records emotions. Say that was not only the best, most glorious day you had at the beach, but it was a special day. You had a family reunion where you saw family and friends and loved ones you hadn't seen in years, and you had the most wonderful day and the most wonderful weather and a private beach. And every time you think of that, you feel happy because not just all five senses were recorded of what happened, but also the emotion of happiness is recorded. God gave us a much better camcorder than anything we've ever made, and he did it, of course, first. Now here we have a electrical motor, rotary motor, and it works by the flow of charged particles called electrons. Electrons are negatively charged particles. But God invented a rotary motor first that every one of you has in your body by the multiple quadrillions. And if you didn't have these tiny little motors that work like an electrical motor, except there is a big difference. It works with the flow of positively charged particles called protons instead of negatively charged electrons. This flow is built up by metabolic processes. It has eight different complex proteins. Each protein is so complex that, like a DNA molecule, trillions of years will not suffice for it to happen by chance. You have eight of them in here. Structural proteins, as well as what we call catalytic proteins, called enzymes, that catalyze a specific chemical reaction. This thing can rotate up to several thousand RPM, and each complete revolution produces three ATP molecules. It uses its catalytic ability to take adenosine diphosphate and bond it with inorganic phosphate to produce adenosine triphosphate, which is the most important energy currency at the cellular level. Everything in the world of biology, from plants to animals to great blue whales to human beings, has to have ATP in their cells, or you have no energy at the cellular level. In fact, that's why you'll die within minutes if somebody gives you cyanide. It cripples one critical enzyme in the metabolic process, cytochrome oxidase, and that causes a chain reaction failure, resulting in the stoppage of these machines. And therefore, ATP is no longer recycled. Now, your cell at any one time has about a billion molecules of ATP in it. But once those machines stop, then the residual is consumed within a few minutes. The cellular processes use it up that fast. That's why you die within minutes if you take cyanide. But these rotary machines are the tiniest known rotary machines to exist in the universe, even smaller than the rotary propulsion system of the E. coli bacterium. That has 40 proteins in its structure. This has only 8. It's only about 10 nanometers in length. A nanometer is a billionth of a meter. That means these machines are so tiny that they estimate within the volume of a head of a pin, it could contain 10 to the 17th power of these little machines. That's 100 quadrillion machines in the head of a pin. In the mitochondria of your cells, the powerhouses of your cells, you have at least 1,000 of these and probably much more. But they estimate on the average we have about 60 trillion cells in our body. And in the powerhouses of those cells, at least 1,000 or more of these little machines. Now, 1,000 trillion is a quadrillion, meaning you have more than 60 quadrillion of these machines in your body. It's not only the tiniest and most efficient machine that we know to exist, it exists in larger numbers than all the machines that have ever been created in the history of mankind. You have that in your body because God made us fearfully and wonderfully made. And if these machines weren't there and running, you would die within minutes from lack of energy. Talk about being dead tired, you'd be dead tired. Okay. Now, man thought that he invented cogged gear wheels, and this is the basis of all kinds of mechanical wind-up mechanisms, clocks especially. But even this, we found out a few years ago, is not something man thought of first. God invented it first and gave this cogged gear wheel technology to an insect. And it's called the leafhopper, and it is indigenous to parts of Eastern Europe and parts of Northern Africa. And in its juvenile stage, it has to lock its rear legs so that they jump in synchrony. If you get too much power on one leg or the other, it would just go to one end or the other, wouldn't be able to jump straight. So it has to have something like cogged gear wheels to lock them in synchrony and make them work perfectly. God invented that. Here where the legs conjoin, you have the toothed gear wheels of this cog system. The legs come out here and here. But this, like cogs in a gear wheel, makes sure that they work in perfect synchrony. How do the evolutionists explain this? They said, we usually think of gears as something we see in human-designed machinery. These gears are not designed. They are evolved, representing high-speed and precision machinery evolved for synchronization in the animal world. Well, now, this is the classical fallacy known as the undocumented assertion. Just saying it doesn't make it so. He says that these precision machines evolved. Okay, has anybody observed this type of evolution? No. Has anyone in the history of the world ever seen complex information come without an author, or complex precision machinery arise without an intelligent designer and inventor? No. The laws of chemistry and physics and chance make this impossible. And in fact, every living creature, and we've looked at just some of the marvelous things that God has created today that he thought of first and made better than we ever did when we thought of it later. His intelligence had to make it up first. If it took our intelligence to do it later, it took his greater intelligence to do it first. But, you know, so many people say, well, I'd believe in your God, your creator, if he'd come down and do a miracle for me. Well, God, in Romans 1:20, says, open your eyes. There are millions of miracles all around us. Every living creature is a miracle. If we define a miracle as something that is supernatural, beyond what natural processes of chemistry, physics, and chance can do, and also superhuman, beyond what the best human technology can achieve, then every living creature is a miracle because it is both supernatural and superhuman. It cannot be explained either way. Only an omniscient, omnipotent God could do such a thing, and that God actually showed up in history in the person of Jesus Christ, demonstrating his power as the Creator, excuse me, and rising from the dead to boot, fulfilling prophecy to prove that he was who he claimed to be. So the miracles are there, and the doubters, God says in Romans 1:20, are literally without excuse. For since the creation of the world, his invisible nature and attributes, that is, his eternal power and divinity, have been made intelligible and clearly discernible in and through the things that have been made, his handiworks. We've looked at just some of his amazing handiworks today, none of which can be explained by time and chance, natural laws of chemistry and physics, or by the greatest human technology. They are, in fact, supernatural, superhuman, and miracles in their own right. Therefore, men are without excuse, altogether without any defense or justification. Well, I do have this available on DVD, and I'll be back at the DVD table if you have any final questions. But I'm glad to have you come out today. It's always a pleasure to share the glories of God's creation and the wonders of our Creator, who we are honored to be made in his image and to know him for eternity as his children and his bride. Pastor Rick, I'll invite you up to close us out. Thank you so much again.